will be distracted by my beard from what I'm going to say. I could justify this beard if this was a class in dialectics by asking you to determine at what stage you can say that I merely was unshaven and when it became a beard. Or to come to the subject of tonight a little closer, there's a kind of thinking that could be carried to the absurd that Marx had a beard and Engels had a beard, Lenin and Trotsky, and therefore you need a beard in order to be a Marxist. That kind of thinking is not too remote from some of the objections to Marxism that we're going to take up. I want to say a word or two about the teacher and the class. A year or two ago, one comrade remarked to another that I seemed to understand a lot about the Negro struggle, but didn't seem to be so effective in communicating it or explaining it so that others could understand it. And my initial reaction was hurt. My feelings are as tender and bruised just as easily as any other man's or woman's. But after a while, I concluded that this is probably true, in my case, and generally true, that important things can be learned only by ourselves. No substitute can do it for us. No teacher is a substitute for reading and thinking. Classes only introduce us to a subject. We have to do the study by ourselves. So with that, I would like to ask, how many people have read the assignment for today? Well, that's pretty good. I would suggest that those who haven't read it yet, read it in preparation for our next session. The title of these classes should really be The Marxist Theory of the Negro Struggle rather than The Theory of the Negro Struggle. And in order to approach this theory, I think that it's necessary for us to examine what Marxism is, what we mean by Marxism, which is quite different from what most of the opponents of Marxism think it is. In this case, quite different from what Harold Cruse, the author of one of the things assigned for reading, Marxism and the Negro, thinks it is. He apparently, at one level, considers it to be some kind of a dogma. Marx said so-and-so. That's Marxism. And if you don't say what Marx said, that's not Marxism. The attitude of the Marxists is entirely different. We don't consider Marx to be infallible, and we certainly don't think that there was anything magic about him, that he could 100 years ago foresee the conditions and problems that exist today and provide the answers for them. He didn't write any book that provides such answers. There is no book like that. I would like to add to the list of reading that you have another pamphlet which illustrates the approach of genuine Marxists to what Marx said. The pamphlet I refer to is by Trotsky. It's called The Communist Manifesto Today. This is an introduction which Trotsky wrote. Today means 1938. This is the introduction by Trotsky to the first publication of the Communist Manifesto in South Africa in the Afrikaans language. And he was asked by his comrades there to write an introduction to the Communist Manifesto, and he took as his subject what there is in Marx that is alive and valid today, and what has to be changed. This is the real approach to what Marx said, that is constructive. What Trotsky does in this pamphlet is he begins by saying, what are the things now, 90 years after the Communist Manifesto was written, that are still valid and applicable to our time? And then he goes ahead and he lists them. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, down on. He lists about 12 things, which he says are just as true in 1938 as they were in 1848. Then he continues as follows. Thus we see that the joint and rather brief production of two young authors, Marx was then 29, Engels 27, still continues to give irreplaceable directives upon the most important and burning questions of the struggle for emancipation. What other book could even distantly be compared in this respect with the Communist Manifesto? But this does not imply that after 90 years of unprecedented development of productive forces and vast social struggles, the manifesto needs neither corrections nor additions. Revolutionary thought has nothing in common with idol worship. Programs and prognoses are tested and corrected in the light of experience, which is the supreme criterion of human reason. The manifesto, too, requires corrections and additions. However, as is evidenced by historical experience itself, these corrections and additions can be successfully made only by proceeding in accord with the method lodged in the foundation of the manifesto itself. We shall try to indicate this in several most important instances. And then he goes ahead, 1, 2, 3, and so on, making a list of the things on which Marx was wrong, on which he foresaw incorrectly, incompletely, in which he predicted wrongly, in which he omitted important things. Marx, for example, expected the revolution very soon. They thought that the bourgeois revolution in Germany of 1848 was going to be followed very quickly by the proletarian revolution throughout Western Europe. Well, this obviously was an error in prediction. Trotsky points out what the error was and why it occurred. And so on, he goes through a number of important points on which Marx has to be corrected and added to. For example, point number 7 of these, he says, while depicting how capitalism always draws into the vortex backward and barbarous countries, the manifesto contains no reference to the struggle of colonial and semi-colonial countries for independence. To the extent that Marx and Engels considered the social revolution in the leading countries, at least, to be a matter of the next few years, the colonial question was resolved automatically for them, not in consequence of an independent movement of oppressed nationalities, but in consequence of the victory of the proletariat in the metropolitan centers of capitalism. The questions of revolutionary strategy in colonial and semi-colonial countries are therefore not touched on at all by the manifesto. Yet these conditions demand an independent solution. For example, it is quite evident that while the national fatherland, in quotes, has become the most baneful historical break in advanced capitalist countries, it still remains a relatively progressive factor in backward countries compelled to struggle for an independent existence. The communists, declares the manifesto, everywhere support every revolutionary movement against the existing social and political order of things, end quote. And Trotsky adds, the movement of the colored races against their imperialist oppressors is one of the most important and powerful movements against the existing order, and therefore calls for the complete, unconditional, and unlimited support on the part of the proletariat of the white race. The credit for developing revolutionary strategy for oppressed nationalities belongs primarily to Lenin. Now, there are those, I say, who take the opposite attitude and conclude that those who do not merely repeat what Marx said are not Marxists. And this is the view held by Harold Cruz in his articles in The Liberator. He says that people like Trotsky tampered with Marxism so much that they can no longer be considered Marxists, that they deviated from what Marx said so much that they are not Marxists really, and Marxism has been led into an insoluble crisis as a result of these deviations and this tampering. Now, what he means is understandable from the only example he gives of such tampering. That is, the making of the Russian Revolution. This, to him, is a real deviation from Marx. Why? Because Marx said that the revolution is going to come first in the advanced capitalist countries. And Russia was not an advanced capitalist country. It was a backward country. Marx said it was going to come in the advanced countries because that's where the industrial system was most developed and where a strong working class was created. And that these workers were the ones who were going to overthrow the capitalist system in those countries. Then it would spread to the rest of the world. Trotsky and Lenin, who lived later than Marx, came to a different conclusion. They came to the conclusion that this prediction of Marx was not an essential part of Marxism. They considered this a minor part, a prediction merely. They came to the conclusion that it was not only possible, but probable that the revolution could take place first in a backward country. Now this did create a crisis among the Marxists of that time. Many of the Marxists, the Mensheviks in Russia, Social Democrats in Western Europe, said that it's ridiculous, it's un-Marxist, it's wrong, it's harmful to make a revolution in a backward country. But at any rate, they said, whether it was all these things, it certainly was not Marxist to do so. And this is one of the charges that was leveled against the Russian Revolution, that it was not a Marxist revolution. Well, of course, we are not in that school. We understand what happened. We understand why Marx made this prediction. And we understand that a great deal happened between the time that Marx was alive and the time that Lenin and Trotsky were considering the question of revolution in backward Russia. One of the things that occurred during this one-third of a century was that capitalism became imperialism, became monopoly capitalism, went from the industrial to the monopoly stage. During this same period, the subjugation and division of Africa and Asia was completed. The advanced capitalist powers fought it out among themselves or agreed among themselves and took over the last independent sections of these colonial areas. And the development of imperialism, the final division of the world among the imperialists, the capture of the colonial areas, created a new situation which was different than the one that existed in Marx's time. It lodged new tensions inside of the world capitalist system. It created new problems, and it created new opportunities. And Lenin and Trotsky, looking at this new, different world than the one that existed in Lenin's time, were able to see among the opportunities that capitalism was weaker in the backward countries than it was industrially advanced countries. And that therefore it would be possible to break imperialism, the world system, at its weakest link, which was not in the advanced countries, but in the backward ones. And that in the backward ones, the capitalist class being weaker would have fewer resources at their command to oppose a revolution. So they went ahead on this application of Marxism to the new conditions of their time. And they made the revolution. And of course, world history has been different as a result of this new evaluation by Lenin and the others, the whole world history since that time. In my opinion, Marxism would have died if these additions and corrections and changes had not been introduced into it, into the body of Marxist thought, in this century. By this time, Marxism would be defunct. So what Cruz calls the tampering and the deviations from Marx are actually the application of Marx's method to different conditions and different situations than the ones that existed in Marx's time. And the crisis that they created is not a crisis of Marxism, but a crisis of capitalism. Ever since that time, capitalism has been bleeding because the withdrawal of the Russian Empire from the world capitalist market is the beginning of the end of capitalism as a world system. We can see that more clearly today than people could 50 years ago. It's certainly unquestionable today that that's when the process of the end of capitalism began. Now, I would like to ask that for the next class, you read the pamphlet, Dynamics of World Revolution Today. This is the resolution which was adopted by the Fourth International Unification Congress last summer. And it's printed in full, in the full 1963 ISR and in this pamphlet. And the first five pages in particular deal with the very question that I've been talking about. They deal with the question of what was expected, the classical expectation about where the revolution would occur first, and why it didn't occur there, why that occurred, what it meant. And then it takes up another question, which I will report here very briefly, or read from, as another example of Marxist analysis, which somebody who has the mechanical approach of Cruz to it would not understand. Following the Russian Revolution, the Marxists came to the conclusion, and following the defeats that occurred to working class revolutions during the next 20 years after the Russian Revolution, they came to the conclusion that only under a revolutionary Marxist leadership could a revolution take place. Then a number of events occurred which challenged that idea. The Yugoslav Revolution did not take place under the leadership of a revolutionary Marxist party, but under the leadership of a Stalinist party. Revolutions in other countries, down to and through, including the revolution which began in Cuba in 1957-59, which was not begun and which was not carried to military victory under a revolutionary Marxist leadership. And this resolution, in its first five pages, attempts to understand and explain what had happened here. And it points out that we can understand this and explain it and benefit from it if we understand the difference between the strength of capitalism in the advanced capitalist countries and its strength in the backward countries. In the backward countries, they're unable to achieve any kind of stability, the capitalist class. In reading now from the resolution, in the colonial and semi-colonial countries, the very weakness of capitalism, the whole peculiar socio-economic structure produced by imperialism, the permanent misery of the big majority of the population in the absence of a radical agrarian revolution, the stagnation and even reduction of living standards, while industrialization nevertheless proceeds relatively rapidly, create conditions in which the failure of one revolutionary wave does not lead automatically to relative or even temporary social or economic stability. A seemingly inexhaustible succession of mass struggles continues, such as Bolivia has experienced for 10 years. The weakness of the enemy offers the revolution fuller means of recovery from temporary defeats than is the case in imperialist countries. To sum up, the victories and defeats since 1917 express the relationship of forces between the old ruling class and the toiling masses on a world scale. The fact that the revolution won first in backward countries and not in the advanced is not proof that the workers in the advanced countries have shown insufficient revolutionary combativity. It is evidence of the fact that the opposition which they have to overcome in these advanced capitalist countries is immeasurably stronger than in the colonial and semi-colonial world. The weakness of the enemy in the backward countries has opened the possibility of coming to power even with a blunted instrument. The strength of the enemy in the imperialist countries demands a tool of much greater perfection. And so the point is made and developed here for really the first time, explaining why it is that revolution has been successful in a number of the colonial and semi-colonial countries with a leadership which was less than the kind that existed in the Russian Revolution. Why they were able to be successful there while the same kind of leadership in an advanced capitalist country was not successful. Now, this is the kind of development of Marxist thinking which is inherent in the Marxist method, but which obviously Marx could never have foreseen. It would be impossible to expect such things from a human being, that we should be able to foresee complicated, complex relations of forces and changes 100 years ahead of time. Now, Marxism is much richer and much more varied, much more flexible than Cruz gives it credit for being. It is not only what Marx learned and developed a long time ago, not only what was added by figures 50 years ago like Lenin and Trotsky when they applied Marx's method, but also what subsequent Marxists did down to our own time, and what future Marxists will do with problems that do not even exist yet, or that cannot be foreseen in all of their complex detail. Marxism is a theory in the process of development. It's not something finished and fast. You slap it down on a table and say, here, Marxism is a finished science. Sit down and study it. Now, of course, you should study it, but it is not a finished science. It is a developing science. It grows in power and scope as it is applied to new situations, correctly applied to new situations. And I've already pointed out in the Militant the names that are given to these additions to Marxism. When Lenin went ahead with his theories of imperialism, and Trotsky with the theory of the permanent revolution and so on, it was said that they were Russianizing Marxism. They were applying Marxism to the peculiar conditions of Russia, which it was said did not apply elsewhere. And we have attempted to utilize that concept in the way in which we develop Marxism. So that for many, many years we have talked about and we have tried to carry through what we call the Americanization of Marxism. The application of the basic ideas of Marxism to American conditions which are unique, which are not duplicated anywhere else in the world, which have never existed before. We call the application of Marxism to these new conditions and new problems the Americanization of Marxism. And beginning a year or two ago, we began to further develop that concept by introducing what we call the Afro-Americanization of Marxism. That is, the application of the Marxist method to the peculiar, unique conditions of the Negro people in the United States, which are different, despite some similarities, which are different in many important respects from that of any other people in any other country in the world. And we have tried to apply it to these particular conditions and to learn to them. That's because, for us, theory is not a blueprint which gives you the specifications on how to build and what to build and so on. It's a guide. And Marxists have always developed the theory of Marxism scientifically by studying what is new in the world, what develops, trying to learn from these things. Not merely reading what Marx had to say and learning his method, but looking at the real world and trying to learn lessons from it. For example, Marx and Engels, in their Communist Manifesto of 1847, developed the idea about the dictatorship of the proletariat. They said that this is what is needed. They said, we have a dictatorship of the bourgeoisie now. We will solve the major social problems by creating a dictatorship of the proletariat. A dictatorship of the proletariat in our language would be a workers' government, a workers' state. But that's the language that that Marx and Engels used to describe what we mean by a workers' state. Now that was written the end of 1847. And nowhere did Marx and Engels try to say, well, this exactly is what the dictatorship of the proletariat is going to look like. This is how it's going to be. This is how it's going to work. They waited. They waited for experience. In fact, they waited 24 years after introducing the idea about the dictatorship of the proletariat, until the Paris Commune, until the workers in Paris set up the first attempt at a dictatorship of the proletariat or a worker state. A very short-lived attempt, a very rough and rude model of it, but the first one that had occurred in the experience of the working class. And later on, Engels, writing an introduction to Marx's writing about the Paris Commune, said, I didn't look up the exact quotation, but he said something like, well, gentlemen, you've been asking about what the dictatorship of the proletariat is. He says, there, gentlemen, there is the dictatorship of the proletariat, what the workers of Paris attempted to set up. And it wasn't until then that they began to have some clearer concept of the dictatorship of the proletariat, which could be learned only from actual experience of the struggle. And today, of course, we have a much better conception than Marx or Engels ever could have about the nature and the problems of a workers' state, because there's been a whole wealth of experience and struggle by the workers in many countries to set up such a state. Marx studied the conditions and the struggles of the workers in Western Europe. Lenin studied the conditions of the Russian workers and of the Russian peasants. And we, as part of our contribution toward the development of Marxism, have been studying the conditions of the American workers, and particularly the conditions and struggles of the American Negroes. And already throughout these 25 or 26 years that the Socialist Workers' Party has been in existence, we have incorporated into our theory and into our program many lessons that have been learned from the Negro struggle in this country and from the ideas and the thinking of the masses in the ghetto. That has been true since the beginning of our party, and it continues to be true as the Negro struggle undergoes some extremely important and sharp changes during the last 5 years in particular. The nature of the Negro struggle has developed far beyond what it was in 1954, or even in 1959. It's different in many ways. Elements which were previously latent have come out in the open and have become very strong. Other elements which appeared to be in the ascendant have grown weak and have receded. And there's a whole new character to many aspects of the Negro struggle. And the SWP has been studying these changes. We've been trying to understand what produced them. We've been trying to fit them into our theory, into the part of our theory that explains them, and we've attempted at the same time to expand the theory to explain what isn't already explained by existing theory. We have been listening to non-Marxist spokesmen of the working class in the ghetto and trying to learn from them. And we have been attempting, to use that phrase again, to Afro-Americanize Marxism. And I'm pleased to report now that within the next few weeks, Pioneer Publishers is going to publish a collection of Robert Vernon's articles on the black ghetto from the Militant of the last year. It will be a separate pamphlet which we'll have on sale. And this really is one of the pioneer efforts at the Afro-Americanization of Marxism, at its application to the black ghetto. One of the most fruitful applications of Marxism that has yet been made. And I'm sure that many of you will agree with this when you read it. Now, these attempts on our part to bring the theory of Marxism up to date with respect to the Negro struggle in this country are not touched on or dealt with in any way in the article by Harold Cruz on Marxism and the Negro. He refuses to consider what we have attempted to add to Marxism. He prefers to speak about what Marx had to say rather than about what the modern Marxists have to say. He ignores our contributions to an understanding of the nature and the direction of the Negro struggle. He refuses to tell his readers what these are, although obviously some of them would be of interest to his readers. And in proceeding further with our classes, we will attempt to take up some of these things that he does not want to discuss, as well as the things that he does want to discuss. Now, for today, I will just say a few more words about Cruz, and then we have three reports that are supposed to be made by members of the class. Cruz is an intellectual who is attempting to supply an ideology, a theory, to the Negro struggle. Formerly, at one time, he was a member of the Communist Party. And this is evident in some ways in his article. That is, in one place he speaks of the Communist Party and the Socialist Workers' Party as twin branches on the withering trunk of Western Marxism. Some of the things that he attributes to the SWP are things that do not apply at all. And when he says that Marxian theory has been upset, he's not talking about the Marxian theory of the Socialist Workers' Party, although that's what his article is supposed to be about, but apparently some kind of Marxian theory which he learned from the Communist Party. Now, he is not a member of the Communist Party anymore. He and the Communist Party parted ways a number of years ago, and he has been an independent figure in the Negro movement, attempting to fill the role of a theoretician. And you'll notice in his article that he believes that is the main need. He speaks rather contemptuously of what he calls the street men, the strugglers, what we would call activists. He doesn't think that the movement is going to get anywhere by just going out in the street and fighting and so on. What's necessary is to think the whole thing out and develop a new theory. He left the Communist Party by being expelled from it. There's a certain incident about it that I'll mention. When he was in the Communist Party, and their headquarters was a half a block away from, their national headquarters was a half a block away from our national headquarters in New York, Cruz had an assignment from the Communist Party to to go out of their headquarters and go down a half block, come to our headquarters, and buy a small bundle of the militant, then go out of our headquarters and go back and deliver it. They didn't want it delivered through the mail because at that time their policy toward the Socialist Workers' Party was that we were fascists and that genuine communists could have nothing to do with us and should not read our literature. And during one period, members of the Communist Party could be and were expelled for engaging in discussion with members of our party. So that they had to have a special arrangement whereby the militant could be gotten by the top bureaucrats of the CP so that they could see what we were saying. Well, sometimes, so Cruz used to do that every week. When finally the time came for him to be expelled, one of the charges against him was that he had been seen regularly entering the headquarters of the Trotskyite fascists. And this was one of the bases on which he was expelled, along with the usual charges about stealing funds from workers' organizations and all the other things that they add whenever they throw somebody out of their organization for disagreeing with their policies. Since then, Cruz has developed independently. He went to Cuba early during the revolution, and he developed some ideas on nationalism, which he began to expound around 1960-1961. All right, that's enough on Cruz's background. Now, I've asked three people to prepare reports. One, a report on the position of the early Socialist Party on the Negro question, the position that they had in the days of Debs before the Russian Revolution. And that report will be given and followed by another report on the Socialist Labor Party and then a report on the Communist Party. These will be not too long, and I think we'll be able to finish in time. And then we'll have some questions and discussion. The first report, then, will be given by John on the old Socialist Party.
Before reading my report, I just want to mention